Okay. I'm first of all, for those who weren't at my previous lecture, I'm Moshe Kapel. I'm a professor of computer science in Bar-Ilan, and I'm very happy to be here today. I'm going to be talking about whether Chazal had a theory of probability. Now, the first thing I need to tell you before starting down this rather heavy topic is that to suggest that Chazal in, 2,000 years ago had a full-blown mathematical theory of probability would be totally anachronistic. Whereas with regard to geometry, algebra, trigonometry, all the foundations of those fields were actually well known to the Greeks in the time of Chazal, and therefore Chazal certainly could have been familiar with it. Probability theory is nowhere to be found in the ancient world. It first shows up in the 17th century with the Bernoullis and Pascal. Before that, there's no indication of any kind of probabilistic thinking. So, Well, we're not there yet. We're not there yet.
Maybe.
Okay. It is not about Hashgacha Pratis. Okay, we may be subject to Hashgacha Pratis, but it will not be the topic of this talk. Okay, now. On the other hand, I think it would be arrogant to say that Chazal, who dealt with statistical questions, they had to deal with uncertainty in halacha all the time, and clearly dealt with it in a serious and sophisticated way, were bereft of any kind of probabilistic or statistical thought. That's obviously untrue as well. So what I want to do is try to find a reasonable intermediate path in which I suggest that there are certain fundamental ideas that Chazal were working with in a serious and consistent way, but without reading into it anything so mathematically sophisticated that it would be anachronistic. Okay, I'm going to try to find that middle path. Now, what I will suggest, though, and we'll get to this momentarily, is that there are certain philosophical debates about the very nature and meaning of probability, which were extremely fashionable in the 1930s and 1940s, I'll discuss them soon, that some of the underlying fundamental points that we find in those debates are actually to be found in the Gemara. Okay? Now, let me start with the Gemara. I apologize that I didn't prepare handouts in advance. I'll read the critical portions to you, and I'll translate them as well. The Gemara in Chulin is the most extended conversation, Chulin Daf Yud Aleph, the most extended conversation with regard to the nature of majority, of following the majority, okay, probabilistic ideas that we find anywhere in the Gemara. And the Gemara there says the following. Minaha milta da amar abanan zil bataruba. Where do we get this idea that we should follow the majority? That is, that in cases of uncertainty where we don't know what ought to be done, the proper thing to do would be to follow the majority. We would say to do what is probabilistically more likely. Okay? Where do we get that from? And the Gemara answers its own question, Minalan. Dichtiv acharei rabim lahatot. It's a pasuk in Mishpatim that says that we should follow the majority. The context of the pasuk is talking about a Beit Din. You have a court, and if the judges disagree about what decision should be made, we follow the majority of judges. But the Gemara says from that principle, from that instance, we can learn a general principle that one should follow the majority when in doubt. Now, the Gemara goes on to ask, Ruba de ita kaman kigon teisha chanuyo visanhedrin lo kami bailan. Okay, I wasn't asking what is the source of following the majority for a case involving a present majority. Ruba de ita kaman. Okay, I'm not asking you about that. I'll explain what those cases are momentarily. Ki kami bailan, when I asked about where we know the principle that one should follow the majority, ruba de lesa kaman. I was talking about a ruba de lesa kaman, an absent majority. Kagon katan uktana. Okay, so now, what we've established over here, okay, is that there are two kinds of majorities. One is called a present majority, a ruba de isa kaman. Another is called an absent majority, a ruba de lesa kaman. Okay, the two of them cannot be inferred one from another. Each one has to have a separate source. And we have a number of examples of each of them. Okay, so the game now is to try to figure out what is the principal difference between ruba de isa kaman and ruba de lesa kaman. Okay, now, let's look at some of the examples we have. Ruba de isa kaman, the Gemara says, gives us exactly two examples. The first example, it just refers to Teisha Chanuyos, right? The case of the nine stores. The Gemara here assumes that everybody knows the case of the nine stores, okay? The case of the nine stores appears in, this is in the Chulin, it appears in Ksuvos, okay? What is the case of the nine stores, okay? So there are two cases of nine stores over there. In fact, there are actually 10 stores to be exact, but the story is as follows. If there are nine kosher stores in the town, and there's one non-kosher store in the town, they all sell meat, and all of the meat does not come packaged, you know, with an OU on it. It's just somebody selling meat, okay? And presumably the meat looks the same. Kosher meat is not distinguishable from non-kosher meat, okay? The Gemara mentions two cases, okay? One case is we find a piece of meat in the street, all right? Now the question is this piece of meat kosher or is it not kosher? And the Gemara says, in such a case, we regard the meat as being kosher because the majority of the stores are kosher, right? Find the person who's going to eat that meat, but it doesn't matter. The Gemara says that meat is regarded as kosher. The principle that the Gemara applies is called the parish miruba parish. Anything that's separated out from a set is regarded as having come from the majority part of that set. In this case, the majority is kosher, and therefore the meat is regarded as kosher. Okay, the Gemara then goes on to discuss another case in which somebody went into the store, one of the stores, bought a piece of meat, then forgot which store he was in, and there's a different principle that applies over there called Kol Kavua Kamechzal Nechzodari, but that principle doesn't concern us in this discussion, so we'll leave that for another day. Okay, so that's one case of a ruba de isa kaman, okay? When there are 10 stores, 9 of which are kosher, we find a piece of meat, the present majority rule is applied, and the meat is kosher. Now, there's a second case that the Gemara gives, which is the case of Sanhedrin. What's Sanhedrin? Sanhedrin is basically the case from which we learn Acharei Rabim Lahatot. You have 71 judges in the Sanhedrin. There's some case in which there's discussion in the court. 37 of them decide one way, 34 decide the other. We follow the 37. Okay? That's another case of Ruba de Isa Kaman of a present majority. Now, the Gemara gives us one case of an absent majority over here, Ruba de Lesa Kaman, but then it continues on with several other cases. I'll summarize briefly. The first case that the Gemara gives is the case of Katan Uktana. This is another one where they imagine that you know a great deal, okay? The case of the two children, right? The case of the boy and the girl, to be exact. What is the case of the boy and the girl? Okay, let me see how much it's going to require to unpack this two-word phrase, katan uketana. What's involved is the following. If a man dies not having had any children, and he has a brother, that brother has a mitzvah of yibum to marry the widow of his childless brother, okay? And if he doesn't wish to do yibum, he can do a ceremony, chalitza, which is an alternative to this yibum, levirate marriage in English. Now, The point is this. There's something very special about the din of Yibum, right? The rules of Yibum. And that is that if there truly is an obligation to do Yibum, then it's a mitzvah. But if for any reason that mitzvah is not in place, then it becomes forbidden because one is not allowed to marry his brother's wife except to perform this mitzvah. If the mitzvah is inappropriate for one of any number of reasons, then it doesn't become optional, it becomes forbidden. Okay? Now, one of the cases in which it would be forbidden is if those who were involved, right, the living brother and the widow, are incapable of having children. Now, the reason for the mitzvah is so that the childless brother may have an heir through this substitute, through this levirate marriage, right? But if an heir is impossible, then the mitzvah doesn't apply, and chalitza has to be done, right? The brother can't marry, or you may not even need chalitza in some cases. Now, the question is, what happens if there's uncertainty regarding the ability of the two characters in our drama to have children? Okay. Now, the case that they give then is a case of two children themselves. Okay. When we have two children themselves who are involved in the story, we don't know whether or not they're capable of having children, and therefore we don't know whether there's a mitzvah to do Yibum, or if it's forbidden to do Yibum, okay? And we need to decide. And what the Gemara says is, in such a case, we simply follow the general majority. Most people prove ultimately to be capable of having children. And since most people are, we assume that that is the case with these children as well. And consequently, we say they have a mitzvah to do Yibum, okay? So that was all to unpack the phrase, katanu ktana. Okay, all that was hidden in there. That is called, what kind of a majority? That is an absent majority, a ruba de lesa kaman. And the Gemara gives another example of a ruba de lesa kaman, which is when we shecht an animal, right? We slaughter an animal. We're not allowed to eat that animal if it has some kind of a significant physical defect. Okay, it's an animal that is sick and would die. Now, what we do is, after we check the animal, we check inside for all kinds of known defects, and if we find them, then we say this animal is not kosher. Right? We send it over to the trade factory down the block. Now, there's always the possibility, of course, that when we check the animal, there was some kind of a defect in the animal right on that very spot where we checked it, right, where we slaughtered it. And we'll never know about it because no inspection would help us since we changed the situation, right? We cut the animal's throat at that point. Now, the Gemara says, yeah, but, you know, most animals are not trefos, and most animals certainly don't have a some kind of a defect in exactly that spot where we slaughtered them, and consequently, we're allowed to eat animals. And the Gemara identifies that as a ruba de lesa kaman. So we have two cases of an absent majority and two cases of a present majority. Okay? Just to review, the two cases of a present majority are a vote in a court and a piece of meat that comes from one of 10 stores, some number of which are kosher. Those are the present majorities. And the absent majorities are that complicated case of the children who need to do Yibum and that most animals do not have some kind of a defect exactly on the spot where we slaughtered them. Okay? So far, so good. Can anybody suggest what would be the difference in general? What is the general principle that distinguishes ruba de isa kaman from ruba de lesa kaman, a present majority from an absent majority? Can anybody suggest a theory just based on these four examples? Yeah.
Maybe the first one is a man-made fact, a situation, and the second one is natural in nature.
Okay, that's plausible. Okay.
Yeah,
it's four examples. Okay, we have a limited sample here, but yeah.
In the Isa Kaman, you've counted, you know the number that are present, so you should be able to calculate the odds. The other, you're making an assumption about the world.
Okay, that's very good. Is that what you wanted to say?
Yeah, I was going to say the total population in the first case is known.
Right. Okay. So I would have to agree with those comments. The general idea seems to be that in both of the first cases, we actually, the entire relevant population is in the story, right? There are 71 judges in the story, and we're counting up how many say one way and how many say the other. There are 10 stores in the story, and we count up how many of them are kosher and how many are not kosher. Whereas in the other cases, when we say that a particular animal has some probability of being kosher or non-kosher, the relevant population is actually elsewhere, right? This is some statistical information that we have about animals in the world. It's not some particular set of animals that are in our story. We've kind of taken it from animals in the world. Okay. I'm going to go down a very similar path to that. That's exactly where I'm headed, but you know, I'm going to use some different terminology. Okay, and obviously the same thing is true when we talk about children being able to give birth. It's not anything that we know about these children in particular. It's something that we know about children in the world. So there's some kind of general statistical principle based on knowledge that we get from elsewhere. Okay, now, where I'm going to go with this is I'm going in two directions. One is going to provide us with a question, and the other is going to provide us with an answer. Okay. I want to know whether the Gemara regards Ruba de Isakaman as being somehow stronger, more powerful, more convincing for resolving uncertainty than Ruba de Leisakaman, or the opposite. Okay? And I'm going to bring you convincing proofs in each direction. So we'll have a problem that needs to be resolved. Okay? And I'm going to try to answer it by walking you through a little bit of the history of the philosophy of probability in the 20th century. Okay? But before we get to that, let's go further back in time. Okay? As I said, probability, the whole theory of probability begins in the 17th century with the Bernoullis and Pascal. Now, take a wild guess. This shouldn't be difficult. Why did the Bernoullis and Pascal suddenly take an interest in probability theory in the 17th century? Yeah.
It was based on gaming.
Gambling. Exactly. The reason somebody would want to know probability theory is because of gambling. Okay? Now, let's think about gambling with dice, for example. Okay? Well, I want to know what's the probability of getting snake eyes, right? Two ones if I toss two dice, okay? Well, the calculation is now well understood, okay? We have to make some underlying assumptions, okay? Let's assume that of the six faces that there are on a die, each one of them is equally probable, right? So each one has a 1 out of 6 probability of turning up. Let's assume that when we throw two dice, the probability of one landing on some number is totally independent of the probability of the other landing on some number. Well, we have two independent events. The probability of both of them occurring is simply the product of the two probabilities. If that all suddenly made your eyes glaze over, forget it. The point is the probability of getting snake eyes is 1 out of 36, okay? 1 out of 6 times 1 out of 6, okay? Now, let's stop and ask, what do we mean when we say the probability is 1 out of 36 of getting that result? Okay, what do we actually mean? Now, philosophers like Reifenbach and von Mises and these fellows in the early 20th century were really tortured by these questions. What do we mean when we say the probability of an event is so-and-so? Okay, now, the first interpretation of what we mean when we say the probability is so-and-so is known as the classical interpretation of probability, and what we think we mean when we say that the probability of something is whatever, 1/2, 1/3, 1 out of 36, is that there are somehow a bunch of possibilities, all of which are equal in some way. Okay, I'm trying not to get into an infinite regress by saying what we mean by probability is that we start out with a bunch of events that have equal probability. I don't want to use the word. We somehow assume that there's symmetry between these different possible outcomes. Okay, so that when we say the probability is 1 out of 36, we mean that there are 36 symmetric outcomes and one of them is the one that we want, right? And if the question was, what's the probability of getting a 7, right, that the sum of two dice is 7, then the answer would be 6 out of 36, okay, because there are 6 different ways to get the dice to add up to 7 out of 36 symmetric possibilities. So what we really mean is that there's some set of possibilities and we're counting them, okay? That's known as the classical interpretation of probability. Now, the classical interpretation of probability is good as far as it goes, but let's go back to the history of probability. In the 17th century, the Bernoullis and Pascal developed all this for the purpose of dealing with gambling. But in the 18th century, probability became important for a completely different reason. Guess?
Weather forecasting,
it's still no good, even today. In the 18th century... All right, I'll give you a hint, okay? Have you heard of a guy named Lloyd? He lived in London.
Insurance.
Okay, is insurance. Okay, this all kind of, this suddenly becomes big in London, okay, because there are ships going out and there are ships coming back, and every now and then a ship sinks, and somebody's entire fortune goes down with it, okay? When your entire fortune goes down with it, when that's what's at stake, you'd really like to have insurance, okay? So, Mr. Lloyd was able to sell insurance and make a lot of money by making sure that his premiums were high enough that in the long run, he was going to make a profit. Okay, well, in order to do that, you've got to make all sorts of actuarial calculations. You need to know what the probability of a ship sinking is under various conditions, what kind of ship, what kind of weather, what season. So we do get the weather eventually, right? What's the destination of the ship and all kinds of questions like that. Okay, so suddenly probability becomes important for insurance. But now the philosophers in the 20th century, right, the people who were making these calculations were completely unconcerned with the philosophical issue of what they meant when they said that the probability was so and so. They didn't care as long as they made a profit at the end of the year. Okay, but Reichenbach and von Mises and all of these guys in the 20th century who were trying to understand what they meant when they said that the probability was something were really bothered by this. And why are they bothered by it? Well, think about it for a second. With gambling, okay, if I'm tossing dice or dealing cards, I know exactly what the symmetric possibilities are and I know how to count them up, right? But if I'm sending a ship out across the ocean, what exactly are the possibilities that I'm counting up over here, right? I mean, naively, the only thing I could think of is the ship is going to sink or it's not going to sink, right? But I scarcely want to conclude from this that the probability of a ship sinking is one half, right? Because there are two possibilities. No, that's obviously wrong, okay? So what do we mean when we say that the probability of a ship sailing out of London towards New York Harbor in February, the probability of it reaching its destination is 96%, okay? What do we mean by that? Do we mean that there were 100 possibilities, and in 96 of them the boat gets there, and in 4 of them it sinks? Obviously, we don't mean that. I couldn't imagine what 100 possibilities there would be, okay? Rather, we mean something else, okay? What we mean is something completely different than we meant in the case of gambling. What we mean here is that if you sent many, many ships across the ocean, 96% of them would get there and 4% wouldn't get there, okay? We're not counting possibilities. We're noticing some kind of statistical regularity in a large data set, okay? Now, that means we're using the word probability in two different ways, right? One of them is in the gambling sense, okay? And the other one is in the insurance sense. And in the insurance sense, What we mean to say, okay, we'll call that the frequentist interpretation of probability. Frequentist interpretation means that when I say the probability of something is X out of Y, what I mean is that in many, many trials, that proportion, the event that I'm measuring the probability of, would occur in that proportion of the events. Okay? Now, the difference between the classical interpretation and the frequentist interpretation of probability is exactly, but exactly analogous to the difference between ruba de isa kaman and ruba de lesa kaman. Okay? A ruba de isa kaman is the classical gambling-like situation in which we know what the possibilities are. There are 10 stores. We know how many of them satisfy the criteria that we're interested in. 9 of them are kosher. Okay? We know that there are 71 judges. We know that 37 of them voted one way. Okay? There's an event that we're able to count. We regard the possibilities that we're counting as being somehow symmetric, and we make the count. Okay? Whereas in the case of the cows that might or might not be kosher, or the children that might or might not be fertile, in those cases, it's just like the insurance case, right? There's some kind of statistical principle that we believe is holds in nature, that this event occurs with a particular frequency. So it's the frequency interpretation of probability. Now, why is this important to me? I'll tell you why it's important to me. Because there are important questions about how Ruba de Isa Kaman and Ruba de Lesa Kaman interact in halakha that all of the Rishonim and the Achronim deal with at great length and with great difficulty, that can now be easily resolved just by thinking about some of the other differences between the frequentist interpretation of probability and the classical interpretation of probability. Or put it simply, the difference between gambling and insurance. Okay? So what I want to do is take you through some of the problems that the commentators deal with regard to Ruba de Isa Kaman and Ruba de Lesa Kaman. I'm going to focus on one main problem. And the one main problem is what I mentioned briefly before. Which of them is better? Okay? Between a Ruba de Isa Kaman and Ruba de Lesa Kaman, which is the one that we put more faith in, that we regard as more reliable? Okay? And as I said, there's going to be a contradiction. There are proofs in both directions. Let's start with the Gemara in Nida. The Gemara in Nida brings the following story. Okay? I have to unpack this one too, but let's just read the words. Tino kanimtza b'tzad ha'isa u'batzek b'yado. If we found a small child next to a large dough, and he's got a little bit of dough in his hand, okay? So Rabbi Meir says it's tahor, it is not unclean, okay? It is clean, but chachamim mitamin. The other rabbis say that it is tamei. Shedarko shel tinok litapeach, because children tend to play with dough. Okay, now we're going to have to unpack this. But the short version is as follows. People need to give kohanim the matnot kehuna. They have to give a portion of their produce to the kohanim. Okay, one of the things that they give kohanim is terumah. Now, when terumah becomes tameh because it comes in contact with something that defiles, that is capable of defiling food, such as a child who has himself become tameh for other reasons, okay, so this child who is presumed to be tameh now touches this dough, which is terumah, the terumah needs to be burnt, okay? So we need to know then, if we have this child who is presumed to be tameh, in proximity with a piece of dough that is truma, we need to know if he touched it or he didn't touch it, okay? And given the situation, the Chachamim say, we should assume that the child touched the dough because children have a tendency to touch dough that's in their proximity. Whereas Rabbi Meir says, no, I'm not going to assume that the child touched the dough. And the Gemara goes on to explain. Rabbi Meir kasavar, rov tikonot mitabchin. Rabbi Meir agrees that children generally touch the dough. Okay? Umiyut ein mitapchin, and a small minority don't. The isa zo bechizkat tahora omedet, this dough until now was regarded as tahar, as clean, and therefore, he says, smoch miuta lechazaka, let's take the minority possibility, right? The less probable possibility, namely that the child didn't touch it, combine that with the prior known status of the dough as being tahar, the Israeli ruba, and that outweighs the majority. So Rabbi Meir's minority view is that if there's any possibility at all that the dough was untouched, we should not change the status, the prior status of dough from tahor to tameh. Rather, we maintain the prior status. Okay, v'rabanan miyuta kemanda lepe dami v'ruba v'chazaka ruba adit. The other rabbis say no, you're wrong. If we have a prior status of dough being tahor, but we have a likelihood that status changed because the child touched it, the greater likelihood is more important than the prior status, okay? Ruba, a majority, v'chazaka, prior status, right? A presumption of prior status continuing. Between the two, the principle that is more important is the principle of majority, of rov. And therefore, the Chachamim say, since most children touch the dough, we should regard this dough as being tameh. Now, there's a comment here in the in Tosfot, right? The commentary is on the side. Omeri, de beruba de ite kaman kulei alma mode de lo kashinan lemiyuta. Right. So there's this a subtle comment based on Gemara and Yevamot, which I will spare you, in which Tosfos explains this idea that Rabbi Meir says don't follow the majority if there's already a prior existing status, right? There's a status quo, right? The mayor says don't follow the majority for status quo. He says that is only in this kind of a majority. Well, what kind of a majority do we have over here? With most children touch dough. Is that a, right? That's a ruba de lesa kaman. It's an absent majority. It's based on children in the world. It's not based on some counting principle in our story, right? It's based on a statistical principle in the world. Now, so they say, well, that, you see, where Rabbi Meir disagrees and says we don't follow the majority, that's only by a ruba de lesa kaman. But by a ruba de ise kaman, by a present majority, by a counting majority, Rabbi Meir would have to agree with the Chachamim that we follow the majority. What should we conclude from this Gemara? Which is stronger, Aruba de Isa Kaman or Aruba de Lesa Kaman? Right? Aruba de Isa Kaman is stronger because even Rabbi Meir, who doesn't follow the majority by Aruba de Lesa Kaman, does follow the majority by Aruba de Isa Kaman. Okay? So from this Gemara, we have what appears to be a clear proof that a present majority, that one that can be counted, is stronger. Okay, well, there's some logic to that, but let's have a look at two other situations as follows. Okay, it gets pretty gory. There's a Gemara in Kedushin. It says, Soklin v'sorfin ala chazakot, k'derabba barav huna, d'amar rabba barav huna, ish v'isha, tinok v'tinoket, she'edimu v'toch habayit, niskalin ze'al zeh, nisrafin ze'al zeh. What is that all about? The story is as follows. Incest is a capital crime, okay? The question, however, is, can you ever prove incest, okay? Supposing you have a brother and sister who are apparently guilty of incest, okay? Well, do you really know that they're a brother and sister? You don't really know. You only know that there seems to be a family unit over here, right? It's not that you have, in general, two witnesses coming forward that they were present at the birth of each of them, right, and can testify the rest. What we know is that, they're a family. Everybody knows them, right? It's, the so-and-so family. And in such a case, we simply presume that they are, in fact, a family. Okay? Now, We do that on the basis of the fact that most people who appear to be part of the same family are in fact part of the same family. Okay? What kind of a majority is that? That is a little bit delayed. Come on. That's an absent majority, because it's not like we have any information about this family. It's something that we know about families in the world. Okay? Now, in such a case, we said that that majority principle, this ruba delesa kamon, that most families, that you know, most families that look like families are families, right? We can actually put somebody to death on that basis. Okay? It doesn't happen in general, but in theory, it could. Now, let's take a very similar case, okay? But it, the only difference between the two cases is going to be that I'm going to, the second case I give you is going to be a ruba de ise kamon, not a ruba de lesa kamon. What's the case? It's a Gemara, but I'm going to read it from the Rambam. The Rambam says as follows: Yira Eli. Okay, usually when the Rambam says Yira Eli, he's telling you something new. Shekol medina sheyesh ba shivcha o akum haruya leled hoil va asufi animtza sham safek akum o safek eved kshisa hagioret kemo shebiyanu harezo safek eshet ish va bala patur shein hogin ala safek. Okay, another gory story. But as follows, we find a foundling, okay, a baby that has been abandoned, all right? This baby's been abandoned. We find the baby in the middle of the town. We do not know who the mother of this child is, okay? Now, the Rambam says we need to decide, first of all, whether this child is Jewish or is not Jewish for all kinds of halachic questions, okay? So, is the child Jewish or not? So he says, supposing you have, it's a big town, okay? It's a big town, and every woman of an age to give birth in that town is Jewish, with one exception, okay? There's only one non-Jewish woman in that town who could possibly be the mother of this child, okay? So the Rambam says, well, we're going to treat this child as being Jewish. However, supposing this child is a girl, okay, and this girl now gets married, right? No, the child is a boy. And the boy now gets married to a woman, okay, who is Jewish, okay? And this woman whom he married now goes off and has an adulterous affair. Okay, now the question is whether this woman is regarded as guilty of eshes ish, of adultery. The Rambam says, one second, we will treat her in general as being Jewish, but in this case you're asking me to put someone to death, namely the man with whom she committed adultery. You're asking me to put him to death when in fact there is a one in a million possibility that she's not actually married, as far as halacha is concerned. Because she is married to who? She is married to this fellow who might not be Jewish, right? There's a one in a million chance that he's not Jewish, okay? So, the Rambam says, in such a case, you in fact cannot put them to death because we don't know for certain that she's Jewish. Okay, we only have a majority of 99,999 out of 100,000. Okay, that her real husband is Jewish. Exactly. Rambam says on that basis, we can't put the adultering couple in. We can't kill them. Okay, we can't punish them. Now, the question is, we just saw in the previous case of incest, okay, which is a fairly similar story, that we follow the majority. Well, most families are families, and that's good enough. Now, why in this case we have a vast majority, right? There's only one woman in the whole town who could have been a non-Jewish mother. Why don't we follow the majority in this case? There's really only one salient difference between the two cases. And the salient difference is, we already saw that the first case was a ruba de lesa kamon, right? It was an absent majority. Most families are families. But what about this case that we're dealing with now? Is this a ruba de lesa kamon or a ruba de ise kamon? This is a rumor, the Issa Kaman, because we know exactly who the potential population of mothers are. It's all the women in this specific town who might be the mother. We know what number of them are Jewish, we know what number of them are not Jewish, and that's the whole story, okay? So this is a rumor, the Issa Kaman, and it's inadequate, right? So now the question is, what can we learn from this about the relationship between Ruba the Issa Kaman and Ruba the Lesa Kaman? Which one is stronger? It would appear from here that which is stronger? The absent majority, the Ruba the Lesa Kaman, is the stronger one, right? Now, this is something that bothers all of the Achronim, Shara Yosher, and Shev Shmaitzo, all the heavyweights, right, who deal with these questions. This bothers them greatly, okay? Because they're all convinced that one of the two, either Ruba the Lesa Kaman or Ruba the Issa Kaman, has to be the stronger one, okay? And they've got all kinds of reasons why this one or that one should be the stronger one, and each one marshals the proofs for his side, right? But each one is stuck with the proofs of the other side that need to somehow be resolved. Now, I think that the solution to the problem lies in understanding the difference between Ruba the Issa Kaman and Ruba the Lesa Kaman, as we discussed before. There's one very crucial difference between the two, between frequentist probability and classical probability, between insurance and gambling, that I didn't mention before. Okay? There's one crucial difference. Okay? And the crucial difference is as follows. There's a difference between analytic assertions and empirical assertions, okay? Analytical assertions are ones that are logically true, okay? For example, let's think about gambling. When I say that the probability of getting a 7, if I toss 2 dice, is 6 out of 36, or 1 out of 6, right? When I say that, okay, I don't have to go out and observe the world in order to come to that conclusion. I can come to that conclusion on the basis of mathematics alone, right? I simply count up the possibilities, right, and I figure out how many of them I get a 7, okay? There were 36 different possible results when I tossed 2 dice, and in exactly 6 of them, the sum is 7, okay? If I ask you, in principle, if I was going to throw 373 dice, what's the probability that I would get exactly 52 threes, okay? You could do the calculation. You wouldn't want to, but you could do the calculation. It's just a matter of calculating. There's nothing else involved, right? It's entirely analytic, okay? Whereas, when I talk about insurance, okay, so much for Ruba de Issa Kaman. Every Ruba de Issa Kaman is something that's analytic, okay? I can make the calculation. There are 10 stores. 9 of them are kosher. I can do the math. Okay? Now, supposing I'm dealing with the insurance type of probability, right? With frequentist probability. I want to know what is the probability of a boat getting from London to New York in the winter. All right? How do I calculate that? How do I do it? I can't sit home on my computer and just do the calculation, right? What I need to do is go out to the world and see how many ships actually make it across. I've got to go out and gather empirical evidence, okay? So frequentist probability is an empirical art. It's not an analytic, or not only an analytic art. It's empirical. You've got to go out and do your homework. You've got to get the facts, okay? Now, let's see why this is relevant for Ruba de Issa Kaman and Ruba de Lesa Kaman. By Ruba de Issa Kaman, well, they're all the same. Anybody can do the calculation, right? I just go out and do it. There are 10 stores, 9 of them are gone, I'm done, right? But when we talk about a Ruba de Lesa Kaman, when we're talking about what proportion of children are ultimately going to prove to be fertile, what percentage of cows are proved to be kosher when we examine them, right? When you do this, somebody's got to go out and check, right? Now, my argument is this. Ruba de Lesa Kaman had to go through the hands of the rabbis in order to come to some conclusion that it even exists, that it's even valid. Somebody, right, the rabbis had to make a determination that most children are fertile, that most cows are kosher, etc., etc. Now, as a result, they were able to assign different values to these things, different strengths to them, okay? And in the technical language, okay, we would say that every ruba de isa kaman is what the Achronim call a hachra'a. It's simply a decision method, okay? Whereas, with regard to ruba de leisa kaman, since it had to pass through the hands of Chazal in order for it to exist, they, at that point when it passes through their hands, they are able to say, we're not going to regard this simply as some method of deciding in case of uncertainty. We are going to let you treat this as if it is certain. Okay? Remember, they decided that there's a Ruba de Leisa Kaman. They didn't decide there's a Ruba de Isa Kaman. That's objective. It's out there. They decided that there's a Ruba de Leisa Kaman. And sometimes, when they decide there's a Ruba de Leisa Kaman, they say, and we want you to treat this as if it is a certain conclusion, okay? In the language of the Achronim, this is called a berur, okay? A clarification. It's not merely a decision method, it's a clarification. We are going to decide that all families are going to be treated as actual families, okay? We're going to decide that all animals are going to be treated as kosher animals, okay? Or not. Okay, but that's something that they were able to decide. As a result, all Ruba de Isa Kaman are the same, whereas all Ruba de Leisa Kaman can be of varying strengths. And consequently, sometimes Ruba de Leisa Kaman is stronger, sometimes it's weaker. Rabbi Meir has an outlier opinion that treats every Ruba de Leisa Kaman as being weak. Okay, but he doesn't have control over Ruba de Isa Kaman. That's just an objective thing that's out there, okay? Whereas, with regard to families, as I said, that particular Ruba de Leisa Kaman is going to be treated as a certainty. Now, I only have 2 minutes. I thought I'd have a little bit more time than that. I'm just going to mention one last
point.
If
people don't want to eat lunch, they can stay on.
I don't want to compete with lunch. Don't put me at a distinct disadvantage. The just one point that's worth mentioning. There are cases where we find, we already established that the view of the Chachamim is that Ruba v'chazaka Ruba adif, that a majority is stronger than a status quo. But we find some outlier cases, which I don't have time to get into now, in which the Chachamim agree that a particular kind of majority is not strong enough to defeat the status quo, and the question is why. And we can answer that question going down the same path that I've already taken. There's a third kind of probability, other than gambling and insurance, okay? Supposing I make the following statement. The probability that Israel is going to attack Iran in 2014 is 20%, okay? Now, that sounds like a meaningful statement, right? But until now, what?
A meaningless statement, because when you say 20%, what you mean is you can repeat these conditions.
Precisely. Now, does this meet the criteria of gambling? Is there some number of possible outcomes that I can count? Clearly not. Does it meet the criteria of insurance? Is there some repeated experiment over here that I can do 1,000 times and say, in 200 of them, Israel attacks? Obviously not. Okay? What this falls into is a third interpretation of probability known as the subjectivist interpretation of probability, the mathematics of which was worked out by a genius in the 1920s by the name of Frank Ramsey, who's a story unto himself. He was a chavrusa of Wittgenstein in philosophy and a chavrusa of John Maynard Keynes in economics. And he also proved some brilliant mathematical theorems, including the axiomatization of subjective probability. Okay, and he died at the age of 26. So I would really like to go into that, but the upshot is that the cases in the Gemara that we find where a rove is inadequate to defeat a status quo, and even according to the Chachamim, all those cases are cases that fit into the model of subjectivist probability. Okay, they're more like the question of bombing Iran than like gambling or insurance. They're just a matter of to what degree am I willing to bet that that's going to happen? Okay, and the upshot is that whereas Chazal gave variable strength to Ruba de Lesa Kaman, to the frequentist model, and they regarded as decisive but uncertain every example of Ruba de Isa Kaman, that is, of classical probability, gambling-like probability, they gave no credence at all to subjectivist probability. They regarded that as being not probability, okay? And they ignored it completely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.